Free energy now.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Welcome to Free Energy Now. I'm your host, Sterling Allen. You can join us online at freeenergynow.net and see our past archives and see who we have lined up for the future. Today is January 21st, 2008. Our guest is Aaron Davidson of Davidson Hill Venturi Water Current Turbine. They have what they believe to be the best turbine system for harnessing tidal energy. They have a really ingenious design, very simple but brilliant in its ability to harness the ocean current energy. Aaron, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Sterling. How are you? Or is it good afternoon where you are at the moment?
Well, it's afternoon for us. And you're what, 5 o'clock in the morning or 6 o'clock?
6 a.m. Lovely
day.
Yeah,
over there in Queensland, huh?
Sunny Queensland.
Well, I should mention, too, you're a recent addition to our New Energy Congress. You joined us about a month ago. Glad to have you on there. And I'm glad
for
this
opportunity.
Yes,
it's an honor to join.
It'd be nice to be able to talk to you today about what your technology is and what makes it unique and how far along you are, etc. So let's get into it. Tell us about your design.
Thank you, Sterling. We have a water current turbine that's distinct from a pressure turbine, which works like a hydro dam off a static head. We use moving water akin to an underwater windmill. And what makes us distinct from other technologies is the shroud, or the Venturi-shaped shroud, which surrounds and encases the turbine, which produces very high efficiencies, in the order of 3 to 4 times more efficiency than the same turbine in open or free stream. We do this by creating a vacuum or a vortex behind the turbine, which literally sucks flow across the turbine, increasing the output of the turbine, or the shaft power, or the output of the turbine.
As you look at a picture of your design, it kind of is reverse intuitive. You would picture, you picture a funnel, pour the water in the top of the funnel, and it goes into a more narrow confine and it comes out this little tiny opening. Your design is actually going the opposite of that. The water is entering the small portion and is going out through the large portion, and that's what creates the suction, huh?
That's exactly right, Sterling. For those that are trying to get their head around just what the shape of the Venturi or the shroud looks like, imagine a funnel, or intuitively you would think that if you put a funnel with the broad or the wide opening upstream and you funneled flow down onto the turbine, that you would increase the efficiency of the turbine. Well, we tested that in our early days, and we did find that there was an improvement around about 15 to 20%, or about one tenth to about two tenths improvement in the overall performance of the turbine. And strangely enough, we were looking at double-ended Venturis or hourglass shapes, and we had a failure with where we lost the front off the Venturi. We lost about one third of the upstream section of the Venturi, which was creating this funnel effect. And it just left the downstream half of the Venturi, or the hourglass shape, and the turbine just accelerated. It just took off. And that led us to believe that there was some phenomenon taking place there that we were unaware of or that we hadn't considered. So we started looking at removing taking the funnel and reversing it, doing exactly the opposite to what you would think would be, the logical thing to do. And we put the small opening of the Venturi or the funnel upstream, and the broad or the wide opening downstream. And we found that this produced, straight away, we had a 67% improvement in the performance of the turbine, in the output of the turbine. So we started experimenting with different shapes until we actually got the geometry of the Venturi to where we wanted it. And our best result to date has been 3.8 times, nearly 4 times the output of the turbine, had the turbine not been placed in the Venturi or the shroud.
One thing we've not mentioned yet also is that the turbine is a vertical axis rather than a horizontal axis turbine like you see in a typical windmill out in a wind farm.
Yeah, it could be. We could do it. We've actually experimented with various geometries, round or square. We've been playing with vertical axis or horizontal axis turbines because it's very easy to fabricate. When you're doing proof of concept and prototype, when you walk into an engineering workshop and say, look, I want to build a circle and I want to make concentric circles, you can just see the engineers rolling their eyes and the fabricators rolling their eyes to the ceiling. But if you walk into an engineering workshop and say, I want to build a square, then they can do that quite readily, and they don't seem to have the dramas about getting the circle right. They measure the diagonals, and once you've got that, you've basically got the shape, geometry right. What we do then is we take any turbine. We don't care if it's an axial turbine. By axial, we mean a propeller on a stick type turbine, like a propeller on a plane or a normal windmill type turbine. Or we can use a cross-flow turbine, the Darius type or the egg beater type, some people call them, because they do resemble egg beaters, designed and invented by Georges Darius in the 1920s. And when you look at the cross-section of a vertical axis or a cross-flow turbine, they call it cross-flow because the flow flows across the actual axis of the turbine. It actually sweeps a square. So we spent a lot of time playing with the square geometry, but in our patent we have included round, multi-sided, 10, 12-sided, 8-sided, as well as 4-sided. What is important to remember is it's the actual geometry of the actual shroud or the Venturi which is creating the vortex or the sub-atmosphere of low pressure behind the turbine, which makes it work. But we could use any turbine.
So the key of your patent is the Venturi shape, not the blade or the turbine that's spinning in the opening of that.
That's correct. We claim to have a world-leading design, if not world-best design. However, our specialty is actually the Venturi, not the actual turbine itself.
Mm-hmm. Now, another thing we've not mentioned yet is that the edges, the left and the right of this Venturi shape, this reverse funnel, are not solid. You actually have little fins going along there, so the water can come in, and you have those fins with different shapes, and that apparently accentuates the effect.
Absolutely. We have an area of low pressure or of flow, which is really, when we started investigating what was happening both inside the Venturi and outside the Venturi, we found there were certain dead zones. So what we found was as the pressure was lower inside the Venturi than the pressure outside, if we introduced vents in the actual sides of the Venturi, in the side panels, and staggered caused the Venturi to be made up of what we call cascading hydropanels, then we could inject pressure from the outside into the Venturi, as well as having that augmentation or that suck, that sub-atmosphere drawing flow across the turbine, and we could increase the performance of the actual venturi and therefore the turbine by injecting flow behind the turbine and reinvigorating the flow, maintaining the boundary layer and reducing some of the turbulence that was in the venturi itself. And that is one of the features of our patent.
How much did adding that attribute affect the efficiency of the design? If you had a solid surface versus the thinned surface?
About 25 to 30%, Sterling. It was really quite a remarkable difference. We found that there were a number of things that we had to get right, and the first thing was the actual geometry. Once we had the geometry of the venturi actually fixed, we then started tweaking it, and we got to a stage where we had both the geometry and the geometry made up of these cascading hydrofoils, or you could almost call them aerofoils. Imagine if you snapped the wings off a plane and stood them up vertically. Each wing would be producing lift or an accelerated flow across the lift surface of the wing. As you bring the two lift surfaces together, if you face them inward on one another, you would then have an area that would be producing an increased velocity. And that's pretty much how the venturi works. And that's where we put the turbine, at that optimum position in the venturi or the shroud, where those two outer surfaces or those two lift surfaces are creating that increased or improved velocity or improved augmentation of the flow.
How much of this did you do via animations and computer versus actual prototyping?
We found that the chaos of turbulence created quite a dilemma for the scientist and for the computer graphic, for the computational flow, fluid dynamics people. The drama was producing a package that was going to simulate correctly what we wanted to do, and it was a very complex matter. So what we found was we started experimenting with what they call 2D models, two-dimensional models on flow tables. That is, in effect, a large trough about 9 or 10, 12 feet long, about 3 feet wide, a couple of inches deep, and it's joined on both ends by two large reservoirs that where fluid is or flow is water. They're filled with water, and flow is pumped across this flow table. And you can inject little dye trails and insert geometric shapes, just like a wind tunnel, except in miniature. And because water is, anything you do in water is scalable, we were very quickly able to determine what the geometric shapes that worked were and what we were looking for. So we did it in miniature in what they call 2D. And then we confirmed it with CFD packages further down the track as we became more sophisticated in our knowledge and understanding of what was actually going on. Before you can actually get an accurate CFD simulation, computational fluid dynamics simulation, you really need to have the information to input into the package. So we started off with very simple, if somewhat crude, two-dimensional flow tank or flow table simulations. Once we were sure we had the geometry just about right, then we shifted across and we started to scale up. And as we scaled up, then we started to interrogate with computational fluid dynamics packages.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the questions as you look at this design, you designed it for water flow. But would it not also
it can work in air? It's just as efficient in air. We go with water because we have a lot of water and there's a lot of energy in moving water. Commercially, water is a more viable option.
Have you been pursuing the wind industry at all with this?
No, at this particular point in time, we haven't. We're in a country at the moment that has need of some revision of its renewable energy incentives and initiatives. Being on the other side of the world, it makes it difficult for us to penetrate the markets with the right people and the right contacts. So we are we're open to the potential for the wind industry to take this technology on board. But our main focus at this present time is getting into the water industry. We see moving water as the greatest quantum of energy under the sun or on this planet that's renewable, sustainable, and has the greatest commercial benefit to the technology or for the technology.
When you talk about moving water, I think of four scenarios. Number one, would be the tide, where the water is moving back and forth once a day, once one direction and the other direction, if I understand right. And the other would be, or another would be ocean currents, where you have the water flowing at a fairly constant rate at a given location. Another would be river, where you have water going down rivers or other small bodies. And then the fourth would be the traditional hydro, where you have high pressure backing up of water and then the release of that water through turbines. And I'm curious how well this would operate in those four different scenarios. Maybe we can address them one at a time. And if which of those you're targeting right now.
Okay. Case number one, moving tides. We have a one-way single direction turbine, which means that we have to yaw or turn or pivot the turbine so that it faces upstream. We achieve this quite simply by placing the turbine on a turntable so that just like a windsock at an airport faces upstream into the air, shows the indicates the pilot and the control tower and the airport crew which way the wind is coming from, our turbine automatically points upstream. We just move the balance point on the turntable to a point where no matter which way the wind blows, it points upstream. So it's ideal for placing in seaways, between islands or the entrances to bays and rivers, those sorts of cases. We have tested extensively on the in the waterways of the of southeast Queensland here on the Gold Coast, and have found that the turbine is quite successful there. It's also undergone beta testing in a North American location, which is under confidentiality at the moment, so I can't talk about that. But that's case number one, where the tides flow, it points upstream. When the tides stop, the turbine ceases to operate. When the tide turns and flows in the opposite direction, the turbine automatically pivots on its turntable, faces upstream, and begins to work again. Depending on the site, you will get between about, in a normal tidal situation, about 10 to about 18 to 22 hours, depending on the strength and the velocity of the tide. And whether it's in a spring or a neap cycle. Spring is the high tides that are around the full moon, and the neap is around the dark of the moon. In the open ocean, where the currents flow like rivers, incidentally, some of the greatest rivers we have in the world flow in the form of open ocean currents, and specifically we'd be talking about the Southern Ocean around the Roaring Forties, where the Southern Ocean currents just rip around the southern part of the globe. Up the east coast and the west coast of North America, Africa, certainly this country down the east coast, we have an offshore ocean current within 10 miles of the shore that runs 24 hours a day. 365 days of the year, and it would be very suitable for renewable energy production. In Run of River, we have, again, the possibility of, or the potential of putting them in rivers and having them serve remote or river communities or provide power to a grid system where all they have to do is face upstream and they run 24 hours a day. In the fourth case, we're not a pressure system. We are what they call a free stream or a low head or a low pressure system turbine. We work in free stream, that is, in open flow. We're not a turbine which actually fits inside a pipe or a constriction of some sort, although it could be put in the tail race of dams. For example, as the water comes out of the spillway or out of the release from the tail water of a hydro dam, there's usually an apron or some sort of a structure or formation that prevents the dam being eroded and finally washed away. These turbines could be placed in the tailwater, that is the downstream section of a hydro dam, in the free flow and could be used to provide a further net benefit to the actual hydro production from a hydro dam. So they're the four cases, Sterling.
Okay. Another question is one of logistics of the location of the generator. You've got underwater, salty environment, extremely corrosive to metallic components. You've got the metals in the generators and whatnot. Where are you going to place the generators, and how are you going to protect those nominally from the corrosive environment of the salt water?
Yeah, that's a good question. We initially were quite concerned about this when we first started looking at it, but then we thought, well, we've been building submarines for a century, and we keep the water out of those, and we keep the people alive and safe inside of them. We seal the shaft where the propeller actually comes out of the rear of the submarine, and we do that quite successfully. So what we did is we started looking around for off-the-shelf components. We produce the power source. We have the actual prime mover or produce the engine or the machine that produces the shaft power. Onto that we can bolt a gearbox and a generator. The gearbox and generators that are available, prefer, are available off the shelf from existing manufacturers. So we can bolt on a number of various we could have a number of variations to the turbine. We estimate how much power is being produced from the turbine simply with our engineers producing a readout of shaft power. Given the flow of the water, we then bolt on. We then know what size gearbox and generator to bolt onto the turbine. The turbine can be mounted, as I said, on a turntable. It can be floated underneath a pontoon where there's no inclement surface events. You don't want the turbine to be bounced up and down by 10-meter swells. If that's the case, it's really not a good place to put a surface-mounted turbine. If it is going to be buffeted by surface conditions, you put it under the water. If you put it under the water and mount it on the seabed, then the actual monopile or the pylon that the turbine mounts on can be hollow, and the generator and the gearbox can be mounted inside the actual pylon. And that way there is a vacuum or a pressure seal around the gearbox and generator. There are very, very strict environmental laws about leaking fluids, gearbox fluids, for example, into the environment. And so we have that ability to keep the gearbox and the generator housed inside. Imagine you turn the gearbox and generator upside down so it sits on the seabed. The turbine is mounted on top of the gearbox and generator, and the whole thing pivots and turns on the monopile or the pylon itself. And it's completely sealed, the power is cabled back to the mainland or to a terrestrial base or wherever the power is needed to be it's not that difficult. In fact, it's quite common. A simple internet search will spit out half a dozen manufacturers of some of the largest companies in the world that produce off-the-shelf gearboxes and generators that are suitable for our needs.
Okay. Now, one thing that we should have brought up early on in this is the price point. I want to talk about that for a second. You're estimating that in commercialization stage, where you're basically at right now, you're just edging into the place of being commercial, you're expecting that you'll be able to compete with coal at 3.5 to 6 cents per kilowatt hour.
Absolutely. We have an engineering tool which we developed over the years. Basically, it's a spreadsheet where we can plug in all of the factors, all of the variables from a particular site or multiple sites, and what we can do then is work out to the nearest couple of cents, the nearest dollar, the return on a turbine at a given site. Given the tide conditions, that is the variations of the tides over the 18.6 year epoch, I think they call it, cycle of tides. That is the annual, the monthly, the annual, and the epoch cycle. We plug all of this information in, and we can then develop a rate of return on the investment or the capital outlay of what the turbine will produce. How much energy it will produce, what the rate of return on the investment will be given a price per kilowatt, and we can then run that spreadsheet forward or backwards for any given price. And we use that all the time as an in-house tool amongst ourselves to see just how cost-efficient any given site is. And we can actually, given some of our improved manufacturing techniques and the simplicity of our design, we've been able to reduce the cost of the turbine to a point where we can actually compete with coal, given that we never have to buy coal to fire the furnaces. The cost of our installation is roughly about the same per kilowatt, per megawatt, as coal. We estimate our cost per kilowatt. We could still be economical at 3 to 5 cents per kilowatt and compete with coal. That's in this country, mind you. We're in Australia. We didn't realise that when we first started this, we were just a couple of experimenters playing around on weekends. We didn't realise that we were going to come up against one of the cheapest electricity grids in the world. We pay about 12.5 cents to 13 cents a kilowatt for our electricity in this country. Mm-hmm. And that's right across the board. Even remote communities are subsidized. So in order for us to be able to compete in this country, we had to come up with a system that would be able to produce those sorts of numbers. So yes, we can quite easily come down to 3 to 5 cents. Mind you, we would much rather prefer to come into markets at 10 or 15 or 20 or even 30 cents or more a kilowatt.
Start with some lower hanging fruit and then come home.
Sorry, I missed that, Sterling.
I was just saying you could go to some better markets to launch this thing and then come home once you've got the price point.
Absolutely. There's all sorts of cliches. Low-hanging fruit, pick the eyes out of the market. Certainly we'd be looking, and we are looking at some of these very, very fast-moving flows. In this country, for example, we have, if not the fastest-moving water on the planet, that is large bodies of water, not just rivers, but ocean currents, marine currents, at 16 to 21 knots. It's just absolutely staggering. We could provide large island communities all the power they need with just a couple of two small turbines. But, you know, at those sorts of velocities, it's just it just boggles the mind. Not only that, it gives us the opportunity to prove the technology in very, very high flow. Given the loads are proportional to not only the turbine but also the added shroud, tying something down in those sorts of flows, the engineering and the structural design that goes into that is really quite complex and quite a specialised field in itself. In fact, our project manager once said that we have every engineering skill or discipline applied to this particular, to putting this particular technology in the water. Civil, structural, electrical, mechanical, you name it, we actually have a very complex engineering set of skills and guidelines to follow to be able to put this in the water. And then you have environmental issues and on top of that, and you know, marine ecosystems that need to be addressed and looked after and catered for as well.
Now, when let's talk about the speed of water and this cubed factor in. You increase the amount of speed in water or air, and your power goes up as a cubed function. Isn't that correct?
Absolutely. If we take water moving at a meter per second, 1 meter cubed is simply one times one times one. If, you know, it equals one. If we take 2 meters per second, an object, a solid object, a three-dimensional object like a cubic meter of water, moving at 2 meters per second, that's two times two times two, which is eight. So every time you double your water velocity, your power as a function of that velocity, as a result of that velocity doubling, the power doesn't double, the power goes up eight times. And this phenomenon makes the search or the holy grail for increasing water velocity the real aim in what we were doing. We were really searching at taking slow-moving water, accelerating it to take advantage of that velocity cubed factor in the equation. If you can just brainstorm, or if you let me babble for a minute, the output of a turbine is really boils down to a number, just four basic factors. The size of the turbine, the bigger the area or the sweep area of the turbine, the more the power. The density of the medium that you're using, that is, whether it's air or water. Air weighs about 3 pounds at sea level, or about 1.25 kilos, something like that. If you take seawater weighs 1,025 kilos, about 2,200 pounds thereabouts. So you've got two factors: area and density, or the weight of the medium. You have the efficiency of the turbine. How efficient is the turbine in air?
Let's talk about density for a second. The water is like 700 times more dense than air. Is that correct?
No, 832.
Okay.
So, significantly heavier. So this is where when you start to plug in these factors, if you could turn around and make your wind turbine 800 times more efficient, just by sticking it underwater, then commercially you have a compelling argument for sticking windmills under the water, which is why we're focusing on water. Mm-hmm. So water turbines, the two factors that we've covered so far are the area of the turbine, the weight of the water. Like a cubic meter of water weighs as much as a compact car. Imagine if your car starts rolling on the driveway and you jump out and try to stop it. The thing nearly rolls over the top of you. Well, water, a cubic meter of water, that's 3 foot, roughly by 3 foot by 3 foot, weighs about as much as a car. When that starts moving at a meter per second, that's a very slow walk. My grandmother walks it faster than a meter per second. Then you have an incredible amount of energy. So those two factors. The third factor is the efficiency of the turbine. How much of the energy in the water can the turbine actually harvest or take out? And finally, there is the speed of the water. The faster the water moves, the more energy in the water. So imagine you've been, your car isn't doing 1 meter per second, it's doing 2 or 3 meters per second, and you jump out in front of it and you try and stop it. There's an incredible amount of energy in that, in trying to stop that car. It's the same thing with moving water. There is an incredible amount of energy in it, and the ability to harvest that energy is what we are all about.
Okay. So given those four factors, by going in here and hitting the efficiency of the turbine with your design, getting 3-plus times more energy out than other competing water turbine designs, that's what's giving
you
the edge in this water harvesting field. Another thing I'd like to mention is, I'm going to have to bring it up again. I just got derailed in my thoughts. Wind. And when you talk about wind turbines and wind farms, you're dealing with a transient and a kind of a hit-and-miss type of situation. You can't predict when the wind's going to blow very well. And so you have this situation where you don't have a 24/7 constant supply of energy that you can predict with great certainty, whereas tide, even though there's some fluctuation in tides and you do have down times and up times, you know when those are going to be, and you can predict years in advance what those are going to be.
Absolutely. You're absolutely correct there, Sterling, and this is one of the beauties of water energy technologies, or moving water current technologies, is the ability to predict, not just today, tomorrow, but a year from now, 10 years from now, what the tide will be doing, what the water current will be doing. You can't tell me if the sun's going to shine or if the wind's going to blow in 5 minutes' time, but I can tell you with a very accurate degree of accuracy what the tides will be doing. And when it comes down to building a business or a business plan around a technology that is going to harness or harvest those moving water currents or tidal currents, then your bean counters, your accountants, are able to very accurately predict what the bottom line is going to be for the business, whereas you can't do that for wind, you can't do that for solar.
What about the, I can see for the ocean tide, a high degree of predictability. What about ocean currents? What kind of variability do you have there?
Yes, look, we've been looking very closely at ocean currents because we have an offshore island state called Tasmania on the southern half of, on the southern eastern seaside of, seaboard of our mainland. And it sits down in the Southern Ocean. And basically what it does is it constricts the Southern Ocean flow between the island and the mainland. And we get some very, very fast flows down there. And it's in around about 200 feet of water. We've put offshore oil derricks, drilling platforms there for oil over the years. We have lateral engineering technique for putting things under the water. We've spent a lot of time looking at those case scenarios where we would array, similar to a wind farm, a number of turbines all off the same umbilical cable and cable them all back to the mainland and, in effect, have an underwater wind farm. And rely and those currents run virtually 24/7, as you say. They run all year round, and they would be able to provide very large communities, if not whole states or subcontinents, with power to supplement the grid. I would add here that although we're smitten with our particular technology, And we think, and in fact we've proven it, not ourselves, but we've had independent accreditors collect data off our turbine and fix the numbers in regard to efficiencies. And we claim to have the world best, if not the world most, the world leading technology. There is no silver bullet for our energy needs for this. For this globe, for this planet. Tidal is just one of the pieces to the puzzle, but it is a significant one that we are not doing anything with, or very, very little with. We have two or three tidal barrage systems where we throw a barrage across an estuary and we block the estuary and we allow it to fill up. Both on the and generate both on the incoming and the outgoing tide, or we create two dams that are very costly and very damaging to the environment because you flood the ecosystem and fundamentally alter the ecosystem. Or we use water current devices, which you place under the water like a windmill. There are very, very few tidal installations around the world, and yet water is a factor of our settlement geography. We have always settled next to water. We have used the rivers and the bays and the oceans to transport our merchandise and for trade. So we have populations which are near water and basically near moving water, and yeah. We don't do anything
just
with
that moving
water.
Let me chime in on that point. My understanding is that somewhere around 90% of the world's population live within like 10 to 20 miles of the ocean.
Absolutely. And when you think about where your power is coming from, I live 120 kilometers, about 70 to 80 miles from the coal-fired power station where I get my electricity from. It's very, very expensive to get that power from the power station to my house. In fact, the people that live close to the power station subsidize the people that are at the extremities, at the fingertips of the grid. When you think about it, I live within 10 miles of an ocean current that runs 24/7. If we were to array up and down the eastern seaboard of Australia water current turbines, like as an array like an underwater wind farm, they'd only be 10 miles from the grid.
Mm-hmm.
We could then bring the power ashore into nodes at central distribution points wherever there are communities or where there's access to the grid, typically at the extremities, at the fingertips of these grids, where it's the most expensive to apply the power, to supply the power, and we could be pumping up the grid. And yet we don't do it. This is just, it's mind-boggling.
Right. I'd like to get to that in a second. I want to get back to this previous question that I didn't quite get the answer from you. I may have missed it. When I was asking about the consistency of ocean currents, and you gave the example off Tasmania, what degree of consistency is there, or how predictable are the ocean currents compared to tide, which is very predictable?
From the limited information that we have, Sterling, on the ocean currents, they are extremely predictable. We have, for example, the Southern Ocean, which I've cited a number of times. It runs 24/7. When it comes to the intimate knowledge that we need to be able to locate the turbines in the particular hot spots where we will get the most return for the biggest bang for our buck, we have very little information. There is very little definitive information for specific sites. We basically know what happens in a river, what happens in a bay, what happens 500 metres, a mile from port. After that, we know very little, except that a few studies have been done, and they're all isolated studies on ocean currents, and we have found them to be doing this at certain times, and we have extrapolated and interpolated the rest of the and filled in the gaps.
Mm-hmm.
What is needed when you do an installation like this is an acoustic Doppler, that is a three-dimensional cross-sectional survey of the flow of the water at a specific site, and it needs to be sustained over several seasons, possibly even with an inclement weather event, to show what the actual open ocean currents are doing, given these seasons, times, and events. So, while we understand at the moment that these open ocean currents run 24/7, our information, our data is somewhat incomplete.
Let's talk now about the testing that you have done, the prototyping. I've not asked you how long you've been at this.
We commenced this in 1996. We formed a company in 1999. And we've been at it all that time. We've been working off and on and full-time for about the last 10 years.
Okay. And if I understand right, you're pretty close to being ready to push the replicate button going commercial. Maybe you can describe how much prototype testing you've done, how many hours, how many devices, and where you're at in your rollout strategy.
Yes, look, we've done hours, days, years of testing. Where we're at we've tested a number of commercial prototypes or pilots. They're about to be applied to a number of different sites around the world. We're moving them all forward in parallel, a bit like a horse race. You might, one horse is slightly ahead at any given time. We have been exploring the possibility of mass producing much of the Venturi by using high-grade marine materials such as marine-grade aluminium and having the parts extruded. And that way it reduces the cost of the actual turbine and the Venturi itself to virtually the price of the bare material. And in southern Queensland here, southeast Queensland, we have a multi-billion, $3-5 billion marine industry. So we were fortunate in so far as we found ourselves in the lap of an area which uses an abundance of marine grade materials with people that know how to work and use and manufacture and fabricate and manipulate those materials. So we have been concentrating on not just hitting the market with the best technology, but doing it in such a way that we can mass produce these and keep the price to an absolute minimum and just flood the market.
Where are you in the stage of commercialization? A few months away? Have you already started?
We have a number of commercial prototypes that have been undergoing beta testing. We have joint venture partnerships with those joint venture partners actually under contract right now. Too much cannot be said about that at this stage because it's certain issues to do with confidentiality and non-disclosure apply. But suffice to say that we have the ability to get into the market and start producing power within, and lots of it, within the next 12 months.
In terms of market penetration, obviously, as we were talking about earlier, a bulk of the human population lives near oceans, near tidal situations where these things could be applied. At what point, how many years out, would you see that tidal energy could become the primary source of energy for the world's communities?
Gee, that's a difficult question. We have a vision of providing the global communities that have access to moving water with power, whether it's a remote community in up in the Amazon somewhere, or whether it be a large community on a coastal seaboard or a coastal seaboard city in the United States, somewhere in Europe on the Mediterranean, in Southeast Asia. Our vision is to bring that energy to the people in the cheapest, most reliable form we can, and the most efficient.
Okay. We're near the end of our time here. I wanted to get a couple more questions in terms of the structure of your company. What is it, a private, publicly traded company? How would people invest if they're interested?
Yes, we are a private company. Myself and Mr. Hill hold the patent rights, which is held in a firewall company or a master license company. If people are interested in investing in this, there are several options. They can invest in the licensee's company, that a licensee can pick up a license for a particular region, a site, a country, and people can invest in those companies. We insist on good corporate management. One of the ways we insist on that is that people who want to pick up a license must have a company that is not necessarily listed, but is on that is a member of the stock exchange, or the follows the rules or the ground rules of the Companies Act in the particular country they're in. That maintains some ethical corporate governance that allows people then to either buy into the company, or the company to list and go to a public offer, a float, an IPO, whatever you want to call it, and for people then to invest on that company on the stock exchange. We also have the ability to engage people on specific sites. Say you're a fish farmer in Southeast Asia and you want to grow prawns or shrimp and you want to pump water. One of the options that is available to this technology is that it can not only produce electricity, but it can pump water. So you can use the mechanical power of the shaft to value add or to pump water, or you can take, incidentally, something that we haven't covered, and just briefly, you can take the electricity and you can value add that electricity by running a desalinator and producing bottled water. I don't know what bottled water costs in your country, but over here, annually we pay about our petrol industry, our transport fuels run at about $250 million annually. Our bottled water industry is $380 million annually. Bottled water is more expensive in this country than motor spirit. So you can, if you wish, you can desalinate water. And again, you're just taking an off-the-shelf piece of machinery and are using electricity to value add evaluating the electricity by desalinating water. And of course, there's also hydrogen production, using electricity through the process of electrolysis to split the covalent bond between the water molecule and come up with oxygen, which is an industrial gas, and hydrogen, which is now being used as a transport fuel.
Mm-hmm. Your website.
Sorry?
The name of your website?
Website?
Yeah, could you give us your website address?
Oh, yes. Sterling, it's tidalenergy.net.au. Of course, all the W's, www.tidalenergy, all one word, .net.au. And we'd love to hear from you, especially students that are out there and that are doing projects. I make sure that nothing falls through the cracks. I love answering letters and helping mums and dads and middle school children and even primary school children, helping them with their projects, sending them little links and bits of information about renewable energy and in particular what we're doing.
We'll also be posting a featured page at PezWiki.com about this, and I'm quite certain you'll be making it into our top 100 energy technologies listings. So thank you for joining us, Aaron. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you, Sterling. Much appreciated. Thank you for having me on your show today.
You're certainly welcome.
You've been listening to Free Energy Now, brought to you by PES, Pure Energy Systems. You may access past archives and upcoming show info at freeenergynow.net and join us for our daily news at freeenergynews.com. We invite you to see our directory of energy technologies at peswiki.com. That's peswiki.com. PES, the Pure Energy Systems Information Network.